When the war was over, Foss went home to South Dakota. He opened a charter flying service and a Packard car dealership before getting involved in Republican Party politics, first as a state legislator and then as governor of the state in the mid-1950s. Whatever their politics, South Dakotans were proud to have such a blue-ribbon war hero as the state's chief executive. We could count on our largely anonymous state getting more attention with Foss in charge. It was during his terms as governor that I got to know Foss personally. When I was 17, I was elected governor of Boys State, a week-long program organized by the American Legion to expose honor students to the structure of government and the challenge of politics. As governor, Foss came to a lunch in my honor, and we hit it off. Later that summer, he invited me to become his partner on a national quiz show that wanted to cash in on his wartime heroics. It was a very generous gesture from this nationally famous figure to reach out to an obscure teenager and offer a spot by his side on Two for the Money, starring Sam Levinson, live from New York. All of the questions were about American politics, and we won $612 apiece, a small fortune in the pre-inflationary days of the 50s. It was my first trip to New York, and when the show was over, Joe asked what I was going to do. I explained that I had to fly back early the next morning, but there was so much I wanted to see. He said, "I think you should stay a few extra days. I'll get in touch with your parents when I get back and tell them it was my idea." When I called home later that night to tell my folks that the governor thought I should stay a few days more, there was a long pause at the other end of the line. Finally, my father said, "Well, I think you should. You'll probably never get to see New York again." Now that I've lived in Manhattan for more than 20 years, I often think of that night and the days that followed when I went to Ebbets Field to see my beloved Dodgers in their final summer in Brooklyn, the trips to Greenwich Village, to the Statue of Liberty, to the top of the Empire State Building, walking by Carnegie Hall and listening to Dixieland jazz from the sidewalk in front of the old Metropole Cafe at Times Square. By the end of my stay, I had a better understanding of what appealed to me and what I could handle. I knew somehow that this time my father was probably wrong. I would see New York again. Maybe Joe Foss knew that, too, when he encouraged me to stay. In the 50s, Foss was busy on several fronts. In addition to his duties as governor, he was flying as a senior officer in the Air National Guard, and he was in demand at Marine reunions and other military gatherings around the country. But there were other challenges outside the public limelight. He had married his South Dakota girlfriend when he returned from the war, and it was not the perfect union. Foss, a restless sort, was gone a good deal on political or military trips. He was an avid sportsman, so he had lots of invitations to far-off safaris and other hunting expeditions. One of their children suffered from cerebral palsy, another from polio, which put additional strains on the marriage. Also, his wife was not well. She was a serious diabetic, a condition that eventually would take her life. The public, by and large, was not aware of the fissures in the Foss marriage. In those days, the private lives of public officials remained just that, unless a scandal became too large to ignore. There was no scandal here, just a troubled marriage. Besides, Foss was active in the establishment of a children's hospital in Sioux Falls to treat the handicapped. He was also the national president of the Society of Crippled Children and Adults, an organization dedicated to the welfare of polio victims, such as his son. So the Foss divorce, when it came, was a surprise to many in his home state. By then, Foss had left politics, having lost a race for the U.S. House of Representatives to another South Dakotan with a distinguished war record, George McGovern, who had won one of the military's most coveted awards, the Distinguished Flying Cross, as a B-24 bomber pilot in the European theater. McGovern, a history professor, was as self-effacing as Foss was bold, but he was a much better politician, with a strong sense of his political beliefs and an ability to articulate them. McGovern, who rarely mentioned the Distinguished Flying Cross or his wartime service, went from the U.S. House of Representatives to the Senate before becoming the 1972 presidential nominee of a badly fractured Democratic Party. As he campaigned hard for his prairie populist beliefs against the Vietnam War and for a liberal economic agenda, Richard Nixon and company portrayed him as a captive of the hippie left. McGovern was crushed in the general election, but his warnings about Vietnam and a budding scandal called Watergate proved to be prophetic. He remains one of the country's most decent and thoughtful public servants. The Distinguished Flying Cross McGovern won for landing a crippled bomber and saving his crew is much more telling about his courage and patriotism than any whispered innuendo from the crowd that saw their president resign in disgrace. After losing to McGovern, Foss went on to become the first commissioner of the fledgling American Football League, often appearing at games in a white cowboy hat with a bolo tie around his neck, exuding enthusiasm and sharing war stories or trading hunting tips with the eager men of his age and interest. When, by mutual consent with the owners, he left the AFL in 1966, Foss went on to a variety of other jobs, including a starring role in his own television series, The American Sportsman. His primary role, however, remained that of being Joe Foss, war hero, or as he liked to say, a bull in the woods. He was a restless sort, and he liked to keep moving. Money wasn't all that important to him. Heck, he even turned down $750,000 for the screen rights to his story in 1956. That was a veritable fortune at the time. He remembers the final meeting in the Polo Lounge of the Beverly Hills Hotel, what Foss called that little cafe just off the lobby. I was in a booth with John Wayne on one side of me and the producer Hal Bartlett on the other. Wayne was to get $1 million to play me. They asked me how I liked the script. I said, fine, except for that romance baloney. If you're going to do a story on Joe Foss, you got to take that out. The screenwriter, who had contrived a love story to go with the combat, said, we need that to make a show for the public. Foss said, I just turned them down flat. It wasn't me at all. After all, Foss knew what he had been through in the skies over the Pacific wasn't a love story. It was kill or be killed, pure and simple. Or, as he once said, combat is dangerous. It tends to interrupt your breathing process. Foss's breathing process was almost interrupted in another freak incident connected to his love of the outdoors. In the 60s, he suddenly became very ill, practically paralyzed, and steadily losing weight. No one could figure out what was wrong until finally his condition was accurately analyzed as arsenic poisoning, probably from chewing on insecticide-soaked weeds while filming his outdoor television show. That experience and his second wife, Dee Dee, led him to a life-changing experience. Joe Foss became an enthusiastic, born-again Christian. For an old whiskey-drinking, cigar-smoking master of profanity who'd been an absentee father and husband for much of his first marriage, this was a complete makeover, with one exception. As a fundamental Christian who takes the Bible as the literal truth, Joe Foss had found a theology to match his personal philosophy. There is no middle ground in his life. As president of the National Rifle Association, he was proud to appear on the cover of Time magazine with his six guns. He believes fervently in the Second Amendment to the Constitution, and he thinks that crew that wants to take the Constitution a section at a time has got it all wrong. The only piece of paper that's outlasted the Constitution is the Bible. They both mean what they say. Foss simply can't understand the shadings of modern life. President Clinton's lawyers arguing about the meaning of his answers under oath triggered strong memories for Foss. Folks now just don't have an appreciation of what an oath means. When we took the oath, when we were sworn into the Marines, it was a contract. That's what we went out there to defend. I can still see my pals sitting around when we weren't flying. Guys like Casey Brandon and Danny Doyle, a couple of baseball players from Minnesota, talking about what they were going to do when they got back from the war. Well, they didn't get back. I lost half my squadron. We all knew what an oath was about. Foss, for all of his strong feelings, isn't a bitter old man. He still roars to life shortly after dawn in the Arizona desert, ready to fly off to give a speech to a Marine base change of command somewhere, or share with others what his embrace of Christianity has meant to him. He was pleased recently when a schoolboy member of his church asked him to come to his school for a day set aside to honor American heroes. Joe chuckles when he says, well, I got there and I was the only living hero. All the rest were George Washington and those guys. But at least the school was studying history and thinking about heroes. When I asked him if he thought more about those World War II days now than he did a few years ago, Foss said, Yes, more people seem to be bringing it up. People seem to realize how the world would be different if we hadn't put up that scrap. When I asked if he missed the old days, he answered quickly, "Oh, no. I'm not a guy who missed anything from anywhere. I've always been a guy who just gets up and goes." It's probably that quality that made him such a cool, daring, and effective fighter pilot. It's also what makes him so engaging as a man. His unalloyed views on everything from guns to God to education to right and wrong may not match your own, but you know that he has arrived at them honestly. And if you don't agree with him, Foss, even in his 80s, may think of you as a bird or a member of that crew, his all-purpose mild epithets. But he won't take time to hate you. He's much too busy for hate. As he says of his World War II experience and what it should mean to others, those of us who lived have to represent those who didn't make it.